This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, the 300 millionth American will be born tomorrow morning at about 7:46 Eastern Time. The milestone offers us an opportunity to look back on how the nation has changed and where it's headed. In many respects, the country looks very different than it did in 1967, the year we hit the 200 million mark. For one, we're a lot more colorful. 39 years ago, the population was much whiter than it is today. We're also getting older thanks to advances in medicine and the aging baby boomer generation. Cars are an even bigger part of our lives as more Americans leave the cities of the Midwest and the Northeast for suburbs in the Southwest. Parts of the Great Plains have lost so much population that they now qualify under the old definition of frontier. These changes in demographics directly affect issues like immigration and race, health care, and the environment. As the population continues to grow nationwide, the only thing we can confidently predict is more change. Later on, an update on the impact of the earthquake that shook the Hawaiian Islands. But first, America at 300 million. How has population growth affected you and your town? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Joining us now from a studio at Cornell University is Martha Farnsworth Ritchie, former director of the U.S. Census Bureau, now a demographer at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Glad to be here, Neil.
And what does 300 million mean to you?
I think 300 million means that we're facing a lot of choices that we hadn't had to face before. Some of them are very simple choices, lifestyle choices. For instance, when I was a kid, my dad used to come home for lunch when I was in elementary school. By the time I graduated from high school, he couldn't do that anymore. There was too much congestion. Hmm. We're seeing that sort of thing around the country, and most of us are experiencing that in our daily lives.
Now, the United States, of course, is not the only industrialized country in the world, but most of the others in Europe, for example, face stagnating population growth or even a decline in population. Why is the U.S. different?
The U.S. is really the only large industrialized country that has is looking at significant population growth. We're different in a variety of ways. First of all, as you know, we accept a lot of immigrants. About 40% of our population growth comes from immigration, and European countries are having a hard time dealing with that. The other big difference is that they aren't having as many children as we are, or as they used to have. We're still having our standard 2 children per woman, per couple. That was pretty much our standard for all but the baby boom and the baby bust, depression baby bust in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. But they've dropped down considerably. They just find that it's more costly to have children than we do.
And this has implications for, well, obviously for the economy, among many other things.
Well, the economy for us, it's pretty much a plus. Our population growth. For one thing, we've always built our economy on the idea of growth. That's our fundamental business model, growing markets, growing companies. And we can continue to do that. Now, remember, about most of our population growth is amongst people age 45 and older. We're basically replacing ourselves through our children, our immigration. But that means new markets for things like healthcare, for travel, so on and so forth. So there are plenty of new business opportunities as well as continuing our older ways of doing business.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned congestion, and we're going to be talking about that in greater detail later in the week. But that's, of course, just one of the ways that our lives and our towns are changing. Exurbs, a word that none of us, I think, knew back in 1967 when we had the 200 millionth American.
That's true. And that, of course, goes with the fact that we're driving farther now. And that's one reason that we're occupying per person more developed land, consuming per person more resources than we did when we were 200 million people as well. And that's another reason that we're really starting to look at a lot of choices, bigger choices that society has to make, not just individuals.
We're talking today about America at 300 million. If you'd like to join the conversation, what's changed in your life as a result of the growth of the population, the growth of the country? 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's go to Mohsen. Mohsen is calling us from Fort Myers in Florida.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, just about this 300 million mark. My name is Mohsin Rizvi. I'm a Pakistani-American born in New Orleans. And it was kind of hard growing up, you know, being the only Pakistani-American in the U.S. And now I have nephews and nieces who are also born in the U.S. And
you weren't the only one. I think there was
this culture to them.
I was going to say, I didn't think you were the only one. There was another one in Brooklyn, but I get your point, Mohsin.
Yeah, it's just hard because it's hard to define yourself as an American when, you know, growing up in Kansas, you're the only one you know.
Yeah.
A Pakistani-American. You feel more Pakistani than American. But with more nieces and more generations, it's just, it feels more rounded.
Martha Farnsworth Ritchie, the country, as Mohsin indicates, is a great deal more diverse than it used to be.
Yes, it is. In 1967, we thought pretty much strictly in terms of black and white relationships, and now, of course, we've sort of filled in the continuum, and that's causing some interesting conundrums in places where folks hadn't thought in those terms before. But certainly, we're having a large influx of Asian population and a large influx, even larger, of Hispanics. I think the thing that Americans find troubling to some degree is that the Hispanics, although they come from different countries, speak one language. And that's something we haven't had to deal with before in our traditional assimilationist pattern. People came from a lot of different countries, but they spoke different languages, and they had to work hard to learn English and come together. It's a little different now with large numbers speaking a single language and having a shared culture.
Mohsin, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
In 1967, Life magazine declared that it had found the 200 millionth American. That child's name was Robert Ken Wu. He was born at 11:03 a.m. on November the 20th at the Crawford Long Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia. Mr. Wu is now 38 years old. He joins us now from a studio at Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And I guess this is something that had sort of dropped away in your life until reporters started calling you, what, a couple of months ago?
That's exactly right. I think most of the fuss happened when I was a baby and was over by the time I was in the first grade. So this has been kind of a resurgence.
Now, how did Life magazine determine that you were Mr. 200 million?
Well, it wasn't a very scientific process. They sent out reporters across the country to delivery rooms in major cities. And I guess right there you start to see a little bit of where they're headed instead of going to courtrooms or airports, and the reporters basically timed the births and then sent in the times to Life magazine, and it was a day or so before Life sorted through it and identified my birth as hitting the right time.
And ever since then, 200 millionth American goes to kindergarten, 200 millionth American bowls 300 game. Has this followed you your whole life?
Well, as I mentioned, it really, most of the fuss was over by the time I hit the first grade. Mm. And so from the first grade until I graduated from high school, really very few, if any, of my friends knew of it, only if their parents had very long memories were they aware of it.
Still, though, this must have been something you thought about as you grew up, as this distinction sort of followed you, at least in your family, if not in the major news media.
Oh, sure. I mean, it was something that I was always aware of, and a part of me wanted to, you know, make sure that I sort of lived up to the distinction to the extent that anyone looked at it as sort of an indicator of where the U.S. was.
Well, one of the things I read that you did live up to the distinction in terms of your SAT scores, you were supposed to be the smartest kid in the state of Georgia.
Oh, I think that was a vast overstatement.
Yet you and your family have become quite accomplished.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I think that I really have to give the credit to my parents, especially in view of my brothers and my sister. They've all, you know, achieved much as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because of my parents' emphasis on education and all of that.
And your parents were immigrants?
My mother immigrated when she was 15, came from Canton. And my dad is actually a third-generation Chinese-American born and raised in Augusta, Georgia.
And Martha Farnsworth Ritchie, let me bring you in on this. Given that demographic background, it sounds to me like Bobby Wu is just about a typical American.
I think Bobby Wu was typical of the direction we're going in, at least right now, during the this past 100 million years, because he is Asian and he is highly educated. And that really has been one of the major defining things of our population. We are so much more educated as a population than we were when Bobby was born. About half of Americans now go to college. You remember the baby boom, a quarter of them got college degrees, and that was a tremendous change from what we'd had in the past. So we have a much, much a higher standard for education. At the same time, this is one of the reasons people are concerned about so many of our new immigrants that come from countries where they don't have that push for education and don't come in with the levels of education that they really need to compete in this country.
Bobby Wu is going to be able, if he wishes to shake the hand of the baby that's declared the 300 millionth American. Is he likely to meet 400 million?
Oh, very likely. Very likely. We're expecting to hit the 400 million maybe a year sooner than it took to get to this 300 million. So Bobby should be well alive then. Remember, our life expectancy is growing too. And that's one of the main reasons for this population growth. It isn't just immigration. As I said earlier, we're only having enough babies to replace ourselves. So the largest part of our population growth is that people aren't dying as soon as they used to do.
Mm-hmm. So, Bobby Wu, by my calculations, that should happen when you're in your 70s and just entering your midlife crisis, I guess.
That's right. That's right.
Bobby Wu, thanks very much for being with us today. Good luck to you.
Well, thanks for having me.
And I guess this distinction follows you to the OBIT page. You will always be 200 millionth American. Bobby Wu lives in Atlanta, Georgia. According to Life magazine, he was the 200 millionth American, and he joins us today from a studio at Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta, Georgia. When we come back from a break, we'll continue to take your calls about what's important about reaching the 300 million mark and growing. How has your town changed? How has your life changed? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about America at 300 million people and what crossing that threshold means to the country. It's expected to happen, by the way, early tomorrow morning. We've collected some interesting facts from the Census Department about life in America at 100, 200, and now 300 million people. You can find that at the Talk of the Nation page at npr.org. Our guest is Martha Farnsworth Ritchie, director of the U.S. Census Bureau in the past, now with the Center for the Study of the Economy and Society at Cornell University. Of course, you're welcome to join us. How has population growth affected you or your town? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's get Anne-Marie on the line. Anne-Marie calling us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm well. Yourself?
I'm doing great.
Yeah. So population growth, how has it changed your life?
Well, I'd like to talk about sort of recreationally how it's changed my life. I run a small outdoor cycling club in South Charlotte, and it's just become increasingly difficult with all the people moving into Charlotte for us to find safe roads to ride our bikes anymore.
Hmm. You would think that congestion wouldn't be that much of a problem for bicycles. Are there bike paths and things like that in Charlotte?
Not a whole lot, unfortunately. The city has really been trying to have a push to be more bike friendly, but unfortunately most of the rides that or the roads that we ride on are in more country areas, and we have very short or skinny roads, very small roads, and now there's just a boom of housing going up in this area. It used to be you could go out and ride on these beautiful country roads for miles without seeing many cars, and now all we see is, you know, new homes coming up on the right and left of us, and it's just become, you know, more difficult to ride and dangerous.
On the other hand, some of those people may want to buy some bicycles.
I would really prefer if you move into Charlotte now, you just buy a bike and don't bring a car. But I don't think I have the right to say that.
Martha Farnsworth Ritchie, Anne-Marie seems to have raised about seven different points about population growth.
Well, the first thing is that's a great example of the kind of lifestyle choices that we're having to make. This is one of those things where if a community wants to, they can get together and make bicycle paths or take areas that are safe for people to run on and walk on, recognizing that it takes us longer if we live in cities to get out to the real country. Those are things people are going to have to talk about in their communities. And there's a lot that can be done if people want to. But it kind of comes down to what you want life to be like in a more congested and more populous time. Mm. That's up to people to think about.
Anne-Marie, you might want to think about lobbying for bike paths or bike lanes anyway.
I'd be all for that.
Thanks very much for the call. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Now we'll go to Arizona. According to the latest census figures, Gilbert, Arizona, is the fastest growing city in the country. Steve Berman is the mayor of Gilbert. He joins us now by phone from Phoenix, Arizona. Good to have you, Mr. Mayor.
Well, thank you.
I understand 30 years ago, roughly 2,000 people lived in Gilbert. Now about 180,000. That's quite a change.
It's actually, most of that growth has occurred in the last 10 to 15 years.
So just in that time, I guess Gilbert has changed from a sleepy little town into something completely different.
Yeah, it's just dramatically. When I got elected mayor the first time in 1987, we had 14,000 people. When I got elected mayor in 2001, we had 109,000 people. We now have 180,000. So, yeah, the growth has gone a lot faster in the last 10 or 15 years than before then.
And to what do you attribute it? Are there fountains of youth there or something?
Well, Gilbert's a nice town to live in. It's we've got 97% of the kids in our school. This is graduated from high school. We've got the lowest crime in the state of Arizona, and our taxes are among the lowest in the state. So it's got what people look for. We try to make it a town that people want to live in, and so people move here.
Well, you mentioned low taxes. At the same time, all those people moving in, you've got to build hospitals, you've got to build roads, you've got to build mass transit you must be thinking about.
Well, not mass transit. That's not real popular here in the West. The taxes are still low. Yeah, we actually charge impact fees. To home builders, when they build a home in our town, we charge about $16,000 in fees that go to the roads and mm-hmm. the public infrastructure.
Sewers and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so it's a pay-as-you-go.
Mm-hmm. Arizona has troubles with water. Do you anticipate a cap on growth at any time in the future?
Well, Arizona does. My town doesn't. We recycle 100% of the water in Gilbert. In fact, our water table is growing. Is raising in Gilbert every year. It's a little playoff on Las Vegas, but what comes out of the tap in Gilbert stays in Gilbert.
I see. Okay. Obviously, we've been also talking about the growth in congestion, and roads are obviously a part of that. Do people who live in Gilbert work in Gilbert?
A lot of them do, more and more every day, as more businesses. We've grown so fast. Like I said, you figure we went from 109,000 people 5 years ago to 180,000 now. I mean, the growth has been dramatic. But as more businesses come to Gilbert, then more people work here.
What's the biggest challenge you face?
It's financing. We charge impact fees to businesses to people when they build in our town, whether they build a business or build a home. But things like property tax, it takes like 3 years for the property tax to end up on the rolls, end up in the city coffers. And so we provided service for quite a while before we actually get any money from them.
So, Steve Berman, good luck to you. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you.
Steve Berman, mayor of Gilbert, Arizona. He joined us by phone today from that neighboring little town, Phoenix. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Tony. Tony's with us in Portland, Oregon.
Yes.
Hi.
Yeah, how you doing there?
Okay.
Yeah, basically, the way these numbers has changed my life as a Hispanic American is that when I was a child in the 50s, we were pretty ignored, and I always thought that was odd in the fact that there were towns like San Francisco, San Diego, St. Augustine. These places were established in the 1700s, yet we felt like we didn't belong, and since the war in El Salvador and all the influx of immigrants because of that war and after, now you're looking at the numbers, and they're impressive, and we're no longer ignored. Mm. So that's how it's changed my life, and it's interesting to see all the Hispanic names on TV now, and the actors and the ball players and the professionals, whereas before you just didn't see that.
Mm. And Martha Farnsworth Ritchie, you were talking earlier about how in 1967 at 200 million we were talking about largely black and white. Of course, Hispanics have overtaken blacks as the largest minority in this country.
Yeah, so we've always been here. You know, that's an important point, that it's as if our American culture was superimposed upon China, and we didn't really pay attention to the Chinese culture or the people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how Hispanics have felt in this country, that you're in a country that's got Spanish names all over the place, but you don't know who we are.
Martha Ritchie?
Yes, this is really a good example of the kind of inclusiveness that the U.S. has fostered, and one of the major reasons that our population is growing as opposed to populations in other countries that are stagnating or declining. It's a real advantage from a business standpoint for the U.S. in the world, in that we have people from all different parts of the world in our own culture, and to the extent that we tap all these cultures as we export, as we do diplomacy, as we act in the world, we can be successful at it, but it does take thought.
Tony, thanks very much for the call. Good luck.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. Let's turn next to Mark, and Mark is with us from Geneva, New York.
Hi, I've got a comment about, kind of following up with Anne Marie's comment, that as the population grows, we are putting a strain on not only our natural resources, but public lands available for recreation, national parks, U.S. forests, fish and wildlife, refuges, and the like. So I think as we reach and exceed the 300 million mark, we really need to look at setting aside more lands for public recreation.
And Martha Farnsworth Ritchie, that's one of the environmental impacts that you were talking about earlier.
That's for sure. You know, it's partly the recreation, and it's partly things as simple as just simply growing our food. You know, we're plowing under about 3,000 acres a day in this country, 3,000 acres a day of farmland for housing developments. I just drove past some of that out in Sacramento, which is growing massively. And that's a big issue, the whole land use issue. Is a big one, especially because our people are going to certain parts of the country. They're going to the Southwest, and they're going to the South, and they're going to the coasts. So it's a problem as to getting recreational land where they are. There's a lot of land pressure in those areas.
I'm sorry, Mark, you were going to say something?
Yeah, just kind of following up with that, just as a side note, that the old Sandlot baseball field where I hit my first Little League home run is now $500,000 homes being built there. So that's another way it's impacted me as well.
Mark, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. And I was going to say, Martha Farnsworth Ritchie, you're talking about all this growth in parts of the country, other parts. For example, where you're with us right now from Ithaca, New York, and upstate, and Geneva, New York, was where that last call is coming from. That's part of the country that's not growing, and you've got places in Nebraska and Kansas that, depopulation is not too strong a word.
That's right. We're actually staying level here because people appreciate our scenery and our winemaking and that sort of thing. But out there in the upper Midwest particularly, we have places that are emptying out. You know, Neil, I don't think people would really even notice our population growth if people were going to those areas, those small towns that are emptying. It's the fact that they're going to areas that are already straining from water issues or land issues that makes a big impact. I've heard that there are actually communities in California that are looking at turning wastewater into drinking water, and certainly as the mayor just pointed out in his town, they're reusing all their water. So a lot of people are having to get smart in new ways because of the fact that we conglomerate in or congregate in certain parts of the country.
Let's talk to Carl. Carl's with us from Wichita, Kansas.
Hi, Neil. Good to be on the show.
Nice to have you on.
I guess I'm kind of the opposite from most of the population. My wife and I both grew up in the city of Chicago, inner city, and we actually have moved to Kansas to as part of the urban exodus, if you will.
And to get out of the congestion.
Exactly. I work in Wichita, Kansas, and I live in Rock, Kansas. There is actually such a place, and we have a population of, I'm guessing, about 30 or 40, a very small town, but It's really wonderful for us. We have 57 acres. We're working our way towards self-sufficiency with food and energy. I have a 35-minute commute for a 35-mile drive. My idea of a traffic jam now is having to wait through two red lights.
But can you find a decent deli?
Actually, ironically enough, yeah, there are a couple in Wichita, but we do go back to Chicago quite often for the food.
Carl, thanks very much. Good luck to you.
Good show. Thanks, Neil.
Bye-bye. We're talking about America at 300 million, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation coming to you from NPR News. Let's talk with Dee. Dee's calling us from Ouray in Colorado.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Dee. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Neil. I just wanted to talk about our small town. When we moved here in 1975, there were approximately 700 people. It was a mining town, and the mines closed down by probably the early 1990s. Since then, because we are in the heart of the San Juans in an incredibly scenic area, we found that our town has probably grown to about 800 people, but unfortunately, quite a large number of those new residents are second homeowners. So they're here for maybe a month out of the year, and they've built very large, almost McMansion-type homes, which has made it very difficult for people who want to come here and live and work, and for our younger population.
Hmm.
Our school superintendents, our teachers, people like this, just can't afford to live in this town, so they have to commute into Ouray. It's an interesting population shift, which has not necessarily been a positive for us.
Mm-hmm. And that's happened not just in that little town in Colorado, Martha.
Oh, it's in virtually all the mining and mountain towns in this area.
Well, there's a few beach communities on both coasts that are experiencing much the same thing. Isn't that right, Martha Farnsworth-Ritchie?
Yes, it is. Some young friends of mine are just having to leave Martha's Vineyard because they can't afford to live there as year-round residents with his family, just for the very same reasons. I think the mayor of Gilbert gave us some very good examples of how communities are choosing to deal with this kind of growth if they have the political will and desire to do so. Those impact fees they're charging, I've heard of a lot of towns in New Jersey that are doing that because they don't want their older citizens to be forced actually to leave town, to sell their houses because of property taxes going up, to meet the needs, the sort of civic needs of the new people coming in who are of a decidedly different income scale. So these are examples of the kind of choices that I think people have to make in individual places. Then we have the bigger choices we have to make as a nation as a whole in regard to the kinds of large consumption we have, the kind of thing that means that although we're only 5% of the world's population, we consume 25% of the energy resources, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And those are major policy issues Dee, by the way, thanks very much for the call and good luck.
Thank you.
Those are sort of the big policy questions that are raised by this number that really, the number itself is obviously arbitrary. There's no big difference between 299 million and 300 million. But nevertheless, it's one of those things that forces us to consider those big policy questions that you're talking about.
Well, and I think your point to Bobby that he very likely will be alive when our 400 millionth person is born. And actually, if we keep going the way we are in terms of life expectancy and in terms of population growth, it's quite possible he'll be alive when we have our 500 millionth person. Well, all of that kind of growth is going to force us to make a lot of decisions as a nation on things like driving cars, putting ozone into the atmosphere, that sort of thing, or the kinds of things that we were just hearing about in Gilbert, the kinds of choices people are making to make their communities livable. People have to think about it unless they've gone off into the wilderness somewhere.
Well, here's an email we're going to end with. Several years ago, our little hamlet here in northwestern Wisconsin saw a small group of citizens organizing to anticipate the changes that would come. At the time, we were just summer people, and before we left to go back to the city, we saw the sign on a post stuck in the dirt, "Miracle Half Mile, Watch Us Grow." When we returned the next summer, the only thing that had grown were the weeds, which were almost obliterating the sign. Thank goodness things are still almost the same, peaceful, rural, and uncrowded, at least there in northwestern Wisconsin. Martha Farnsworth Ritchie, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Martha Farnsworth Ritchie is a demographer and a fellow at the Center for the Study of the Economy and Society at Cornell University. She joined us from a studio on the campus at Cornell in Ithaca, New York. When we come back from a short break, the earthquake in Hawaii, how they're doing today, and what 6.7 really means. I'm Neil Conan. This is The Talk of the Nation from NPR News.